Hi there, welcome to How Do They Get There. I'm your host, Sean Penn. So today, really excited to talk to my guest, Andromeda Touré, and she hosts a show on Real Jazz every weekend. It's like Saturday and Sunday from 12 to 5. I listen to it all the time. I love jazz. I love her show because it helps me decompress. And I feel like that's important. She's someone that really grew up in jazz. Her parents are both really influential jazz musicians. Her father, the legendary all-star trombonist, Steve Touré, and her mother, you know, incredible cellist, globally renowned, Akua Dixon. She has this show that she, you know, that she hosts really in connection with her show on Sirius XM that's called Growing Up Jazz, and it's a keynote. It's reflective, and it really walks you through the history of jazz through her history and through her unique lens. And it really lets you decide for yourself, you know, what jazz means to you. I think that's a powerful thing. It's an important message, like her newest album, which is coming out on July 19th, called From the Earth. You know, I think that project, the message of that, or the message behind that, or the conceit of that, is really climate change and how it impacts BIPOC communities in a disproportionate way. It's a conceptual project, and I feel like her projects now, the ones that she described in her conversation, really take the shape of complex, you know, across mediums, media, like not confined to a single genre, shape and form. And I think that's really valuable and important because climate change sucks. And I think it's important to know that it doesn't suck for everyone in the same way. For some people, it sucks more. It's like social justice. I feel like if you were to try to trivialize her, it would be very difficult because her art and her creativity touch on so many different themes. Like, what about inclusion? You know, she mentioned the story about her mom's relationship with Max Roach, and about his level of inclusiveness. Like, I think she said something like, yeah, like he was doing DEI work before it was a thing. And it's true. She does a lot of that too, by the way. We talked about that too. She's also, you know, an accomplished composer. She composed the score and 13 original songs for Lena, Lessons from a Lady, a musical about the life of Lena Horne. She's been a curator. She's been an artistic director. You know, for Growing Up Jazz, she got this award from the New York State Senate, which is the 2022 Woman of Distinction Award. We talked about her DEI work, talked about her relationship with Ray Charles. She toured with him after, you know, she studied at Berklee College of Music. You know, talked about the new album. And then, of course, we talked about her show that I listen to a lot and about some of the artists that, you know, she played recently that I listened to. McCoy Tyner, talked about him. I think Clint Eastwood made an appearance in her conversation. Why not? And we talked about legacy, you know, the legacy that she's honoring and that she's been a part of in jazz and in music. And honestly, an inclusiveness too. So I really enjoyed talking to her. I'm excited for the new album. And I'm excited for spring. Enjoy this. It's sad, huh? Did you ever see Flocka?
I never saw him.
I saw him once in Central Park. Yeah, with my cousin. It was a delight. And he had tons of paparazzi around him, which was, I'm sure, a nice way to go, you know?
Yeah.
Did you have any pets growing up?
I had a lot of pets growing up. My dad kept a lot of reptilian creatures in the house. Ooh. That my mom was not super fond of. And I had a cat. I had a couple of dogs. Yeah. I had ferrets. I had bunnies. Oh, wow. I had rats. I had a lot of pets growing up.
All at the same time?
Sometimes, yes. But, you know, they don't have the longest life expectancy. So something would die and we'd get another one. Or sometimes we'd have multiple pets concurrently.
Yeah, it's sad. I guess it's sad when they die. I mean, I've never really been a pet person. I mean, I've had pets. Like, I had hamsters growing up and, like, mice for some reason.
Yep.
But they never lasted long under my care. I think I was a bad pet parent.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I guess the sadness all depends on how you view life and death also. I tend to not be extremely sad over death because I don't necessarily view it as an ending.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like
transition. A transition. So I'm like, okay, maybe
it's
I'll
like a renaissance.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Like Flacco. Maybe we'll see Flacco one day.
Yeah.
Who knows? He'll just show up. Yeah. So you recorded a new album recently. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's talk about that. So, because you are, you know, a seasoned singer, vocalist, musician. And obviously there's, you know, you're not unfamiliar to growing up in a jazz and a musical family. So maybe talk about like what inspired this album, because I think when was the last one you released? It was a couple of years ago, right? 2019?
Yeah, actually, for some reason, it says 2019 on Spotify. I put it up in 2018. I don't know why. But that album was kind of crazy because I had not planned on recording an album. And I was about 7 months pregnant, which anyone who's ever been pregnant can tell you that it is very difficult to breathe when you're 7 months pregnant, especially if you have a large baby boy like I did. Yeah. And a friend of mine called me up and said, hey, it was like a Tuesday when he called me, just built a new studio. I want to test it out because I have like a band coming in the following week and I want to make sure that everything is recording. Do you want to come in on Sunday in the afternoon for like 4 or 5 hours and we can record something? And I was like, oh, it's not every day that you get offered free studio time.
Yeah. Okay.
So grab some musicians that I play with all the time and grab some music together. So I really didn't have a lot of time to like put a concept together or think about what it was literally like Tuesday and we were recording on Sunday and we only had like 4 or 5 hours in the afternoon to record the whole album. And it was a live studio. So we were all together in the same room, which means you can't really edit it. It's like, do you want take one or do you want take two?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I wasn't super happy with how that one turned out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I didn't really.
Impromptu.
Yeah, it was really impromptu, but I thought it was important to put it out because it is very unlike me to release things that are that vulnerable and that sort of unplanned and unpolished.
Yeah.
And the fact that I actually did it was significant for me to document. So I put it out there. I just put it on Spotify or whatever and people can listen to it.
Yeah, I feel like the rawness, it can add, even if it seems like, all right, this isn't as maybe polished in the same way that I crafted like Shine or like a previous album, it's still a different perspective of you. And it kind of speaks to how you've evolved and how you see the world. And I mean, are all those things like, maybe not conceptually, but are those things kind of floating as you work on new music? Like, or is it always something different?
Yeah. So I am talking about Shine, and actually that was music that I had written. The songs that are originals on there are songs that I had started to write for a show that I did. I tend to write music in terms of shows because I have the jazz background, but I also have a theater background, most specifically immersive theater. Mm-hmm. And so when I write, I tend to write a collection of songs that have some sort of narrative and arc to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that project was about the Japanese concept of ikigai. And so that was the beginning of that. And so I did actually roll out a whole show that's a lot of those songs are on there and more that I wrote after that.
Right. But then you still have Monk, Like you got around midnight.
Right. Over. So that was actually quite significant, that tune, because that is the song that I sang when I auditioned for Ray Charles sing background vocals for him. I sang Round Midnight and I got the job, and I was, 22, I think.
Uh-huh.
And I got the job to, he hired me as the last Raylette to work with him before he passed away. And so I thought, what a great place to start with, like honoring that sort of launch to my career.
Yeah. And also one of the greats, great musicians.
Like Ray Charles and Thelonious Monk.
Yeah.
Come on.
You can't top that. You can't top that. All right. But in terms of performing during pregnancy, because didn't your mom like also perform? I feel like she was collaborating with Max Roach or something, like when you were like a month old, right? Or when she was pregnant with you.
Yeah. So she is one of the founding members of the Max Roach double quartet. My mom is Akua Dixon. She's a cellist.
Yes.
And she did get the job before she got pregnant with me. And then she found out she was pregnant and she was like, Max, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm going to have a baby. And I know we're like rehearsing every day and like getting ready to do this tour. And he was like, well, we can rehearse at your house if that's easier for you. Max was like the most incredible, supportive, like, he was doing inclusion work there. Like he would rehearse at my mom's apartment, or once I was born, he would rehearse at my grandmother's house so that my grandmother could take care of me upstairs and my mom could take breaks to go upstairs and breastfeed me.
Wow.
So that she would still be able to be a part of what he was creating, because he wanted her to be a part of it and didn't want motherhood to stop that progression.
Wow.
And I thought that I just have so much respect for Max Roach. Yeah. I mean, in general, but like that kicked it up even more of a notch.
That is inclusion. Like
it's
you can't get more
work,
inclusive than that.
Right? It's like, oh, you're having a baby. I'll come to you. No problem.
That's like respect.
Respect.
That's like he must have really had respect for her. I mean, to do that. I mean, that's how many people has Max Roach done that for? I mean, I guess he is like an incredible human being. I mean, but that kind of speaks highly even more so. So wait, so 22 and you're a Raylette.
Yeah.
But how did that happen? So you went to, did you grow up in New York?
I did. I grew up in New York City.
Okay. And so it's a lot different now. Yes or no? Which part of New York?
So I grew up on Riverside and 162nd Street, which is North Harlem or Washington Heights, depending on who you ask.
Oh, yeah.
When I was growing up, it was considered Washington Heights, but now people say that's not Washington Heights. So I don't know what it is, but that's where I grew up.
Yeah, I live in Washington Heights.
Do you?
Yeah, I live like off 168th. So
that's
definitely Washington Heights. Yeah, I don't know. 162nd. I mean, look, it's kind of the border. You can go either way. I think it's actually cooler to call it Harlem rather than Washington Heights, because I think Harlem is a very hip. I mean, there's the Apollo in Harlem. Like, how can you doubt that?
When I was growing up, it was not hip. The playground across the street from my house had like crack vials and hypodermic needles. And it definitely, I mean, I grew up in the early 80s. I was born in 81. So like when you think about what it was like during that time, it definitely was not a posh or chic.
It was better than the 70s.
Stylish neighborhood. Probably.
Yeah.
Possibly. I don't know.
The vials. The vials. Did they contributed to jazz? Yeah.
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 I mean, not in my family, but
no. But in general, I mean, there's
in general,
like, I mean, I don't know about Monk, but Miles. I mean, a lot of those guys, they struggled, and they also were very creative. It's like a weird synergistic or dichotomous vibe. I don't know.
Well, but, as somebody who's deeply creative and sees and experiences the world in a way that is, as I have gotten older, I realize extraordinarily different than how most people see, experience, and perceive the world.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really hard to process.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know how to manage and process the experience of life, if you feel it more intensely and see things that, you know, other people just don't see and feel.
Right.
I don't want to say that I understand, but it's a coping mechanism, right?
Oh, yeah.
Look at Billie Holiday, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was watching some documentary and they were showing Billie Holiday and they were like, oh, it's so great. You know, she's performing during segregation in the South and they love to hear her sing. And she's singing to a crowd full of white audience, right? What they didn't show is that she had to go in through the back door. What they didn't say is that she used to carry cheeseburgers in her purse because she never knew if she would find a restaurant that would actually serve her. And she was Billie Holiday. That's like, you know,
Lady
Beyonce
Day.
Status now. Yeah. Like, could you imagine that she had, it's ridiculous. And like the trauma of that and the stress of that. And then also like whatever she was feeling and experiencing in her history, you know, was quite dark and tormented. Yeah. So if you don't know how to process that and have the tools, it's a coping mechanism that was sort of easily available and offered to them. And so, you know.
Yeah. Just another day like on stage and then coming off to decompress and to cope with all these things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
What are the other options that are available during her time?
Right. It wasn't like they had like, you know, a therapist.
Oh, yeah. They didn't have a therapist off stage.
Or like, come have a sound bath, Billy. Like, that wasn't there for her.
Yeah, it's hard to manage her distress. And also, like, she's so, like, no one can really figure out or even get into her place in terms of how that must feel to have this, again, like this dichotomy of being a force on stage, being a legend, like being really the queen, and then coming off, and who is really her support system? Like, who is she around, and what do people really want from her? And there's got to be that vibe and that dynamic. I mean, it's got to be difficult, man. Difficult things. But we cope. I feel like your ways of coping are probably more effective than that, right? Like, how do you cope
yes,
with
I don't
a tough
do drugs.
Day? Okay, that's good. What are your coping methods?
So a few things. I have found that I am, one of my friends said I'm an extroverted introvert. Okay. I love people. I love being on stage. I love being in big social groups. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I need to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
I need time by myself to completely decompress.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with like not wanting to be around my family or my husband or whatever. It's just how I refuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now I'm sitting in my studio, which is a separate, like little tiny house that we built on the property. And this is sort of my space and nobody comes in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this understanding that I have a lot of privilege that I'm like, I built my own tiny house on my property.
Yeah.
Like I get it. But even before I had that, and we lived in an apartment in New York City, just being like, honey, I love you so much. Stay in the living room. I'm going to be in the bedroom just for a little bit. Like, I just need people to not talk to me. Don't interrupt my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I also am a big fan of crystal bowls, of sound baths, meditation, listening to music.
Yeah.
And not always peaceful, calm music. Like sometimes if I'm feeling like a lot of stress and anxiety, trying to listen to like Enya pisses me off.
Yeah.
So like, I'm better off putting on like, I don't know, Bjork's Declare Independence or like
Beastie
Boys and like really feeling those feelings and then just letting them go through me and pass.
The Beastie Boys, huh? Listening to some intergalactic. That does it.
Yeah. Yeah. Rage Against the Machine. Like whatever it is.
Bomb track. Nice.
To just feel whatever it is that I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of letting me feel on my own the extent of it, letting it pass. And then I'm like reset back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that feeling is like overwhelm or just like tired. Sometimes I'm like, I'm just mentally exhausted and I need to just sit here and just chill. Do nothing.
Well, what about the guy, the king of bebop to your left? Like, do you listen to him?
Charlie Parker. Of course I listen to Charlie Parker.
Yeah, you got to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see that? Did you see that?
I was listening to McCoy Tyner this morning. I dropped my son at school and I came back and I was feeling anxious because, and we'll get to this, I'm sure, but I'm working on the visual part of the album, which is like a whole thing. And I started to panic this morning and I put on McCoy Tyner.
Yeah.
Sama Layuka, I think it's called. But it's a McCoy Tyner album. It has like Buster Williams, Azar Lawrence.
Wow.
Like it's one of my favorite albums of his. And I just laid down on the floor and I just listened to that music. And I was like, okay, I'm going to figure it out. And I got myself up and I got back into it.
Did you ever see the Clint Eastwood movie, Bird?
No, I didn't know that Clint Eastwood did a movie on Bird.
And guess who Bird was?
Who?
Forrest Whitaker.
Oh my God, I have to see this.
It's like my favorite Clint Eastwood movie. It's like that and Mystic River are incredible. But yeah, he's so, so good. It's so sad at the end, man. I mean, 34 or whatever? Yeah. Terrible. What a loss to music. So sad. But his legend lives on, as does Miles
again,
Monk.
Yeah. It depends on how you look at death.
Right.
It's like,
right.
If you think about all that he was able to accomplish during his lifetime, maybe he came here to do that and he did it. And so his soul left. He's like, all right.
So you like visited.
I did what I was supposed to do. Yeah, he visited. I feel like we're all just visiting here. Right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
I'm like, we're all just kind of visiting here. So we come here. Some of us come here and it's like, just to like experience life. I feel like those are like younger souls and they're like, I just want to like check out Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you have people here who are like, no, I'm here to do this. Like, what's his name? The Apple guy.
Steve Jobs.
Yeah. He was like, I'm going to like create Apple. He did it.
The
he
iPhone.
Was like, cool. I did it. Yeah. Yeah. And he was out. Right.
Did you see?
You're welcome, humans.
Did
Bye.
You see? Yeah. Did you see the BlackBerry movie?
There's a BlackBerry movie.
There's a BlackBerry
movie.
You
get to watch a lot more
movies than I saw this on the plane, actually, last week. It's really good. I was impressed.
There's a BlackBerry movie.
There's
I
a BlackBerry movie.
I have time to watch TV. I have kids. Yeah. I have little kids.
Well, on the plane. You have some time on the plane.
I work on the plane. One of my favorite places to work because no one interrupts me. And parents will understand exactly what I'm talking about.
The parents. I mean, it's weird because you can't on the plane, like, and we need to get back to the Ray Charles experience. But on the plane, I mean, there's no real rule. We're not pressed. But I think like on the plane, it's weird because you're stuck. It's like being on the train. Did you ever feel like that? Like, I can't leave even if I wanted to. It's kind of weird.
Oh, I just let my mind wander.
Oh, yeah.
I'm such a daydreamer.
Yeah.
And I tend to think in large abstract concepts and then hope and pray that the small details fall into place.
Yeah.
And spend most of my time dreaming of broad concepts. And so if I have a moment where I'm on a train or I'm on a plane or I'm sort of like physically trapped, I had to get an MRI last year and I was like, oh,
wow.
People are like, I hate this. I was like, it's great. I was just daydreaming.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. I listened to a lot of Elliott Smith on the plane, actually. It's a good,
nice.
It's on my plane playlist.
I
have a plane list. Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. So you're growing up with these two jazz legends. So when you're growing up, like, is it just finding new interesting, like, did they congregate with fellow jazz men and women that were like at their stature? Like, was there a lot of that in the house, like kind of interplay between all those people?
So I think it's kind of funny because when you grow up with these people as a child, you don't really realize like who they are. And so one of my dad's my dad's like best friend was Woody Shaw, and he was at the house all the time, like super hanging at our crib all the time. But you know, I have a picture of Max Roach sitting in my living room holding me when I'm a little kid. Like, these people were always over, or we were at their places because they wanted to jam, or they just wanted to hang out, or they were rehearsing for a project.
Yeah.
Dizzy Gillespie was like a grandfather to me.
Oh my God.
I spent a lot of time with Dizzy growing up. And even though I went on tour with him, I spent 2 or 3 summers as a child when my dad was in his band going on tour. That was my summer camp.
Wow.
With Dizzy. And even though, like, obviously I was on tour with him and obviously I saw these huge festivals and concert halls that he was performing in, and I was like 6, 7, and 8 years old. Like, it didn't really click to me that he was like this massively famous person who like invented bebop.
Yep.
Like, none of that was clicking. He was just like, oh, my dad's friend. And
then
I went to Berklee College of Music and I walked into one of my friend's dorm rooms and I was like, why do you have a poster of my dad's friend on your wall? And they're like, you know Dizzy Gillespie? And I'm like, you know Dizzy Gillespie?
Mm-hmm.
It was very like, oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. But it felt normal.
It felt completely normal. And yeah. My dad had been at Saturday. He's still at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
My dad has been in the Saturday Night Live band since I was 2 years old.
That's crazy.
And my mom was also doing Broadway shows where she was in the pit orchestra. Mm-hmm. And so they have matinees on Saturdays. So after my ballet classes or my piano lessons, you know, I would be sitting with my dad at Saturday Night Live until my mom could pick me up sometimes.
Wow. That was your daycare.
That was my daycare. Was like sitting on the stage where they do the opening monologue. Yeah.
Yeah.
With my crayons.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's better than just like hanging out in like just a enclosed box, like waiting for mom and dad to pick you up.
Yeah. It was awesome because like Mike Myers would be there joking around with me or Dana Carvey. Like,
yeah.
Pretty dope. But again, I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're so young. Wait, that picture of you and Max Roach, maybe that should be your album cover. What do you think about that?
Not the one that's coming out. No.
Oh, no, not for that. Maybe.
Not for that.
Different one.
It could be for a different one. I would love to do like maybe something that has to do with continuing some of the social justice work that he started.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
That would be cool.
Yeah, he could. That would be cool.
Okay. So yeah, that would be cool. So Berkeley. So, all right. So you grew up in the city and you're getting this like through osmosis and through your cool daycare, you're getting exposed to all these really cool musicians. Mm-hmm. And then, so when you're like, when your family does something, is there some sort of rebellion that you're like, I don't want to do this because they're doing it? Or is it very much like, I see what they're doing and it's cool. So like, I actually really want to get into it.
That's what it was. I loved it. I loved it. I loved the lifestyle. I loved, and it was also, you have to realize it is all that I knew. Mm-hmm. Rahsaan Roland Kirk has a word that he made up called Ulippians. He's got a song called Theme for the Ulippians. Actually, my godmother, Betty, is the woman who's reading the poem and who wrote the lyrics for that. But anyway, the concept of a Ulippian is a creative person, an artist, a painter, a dancer, a choreographer, a musician, all these creatives, a poet. Those are Ulippians.
Mm-hmm.
My parents didn't know, possibly still don't know anyone that is not a Ulippian.
Yeah.
So my entire life's experience, if I wasn't around jazz musicians, it was like, oh, this person's a painter, this person's a photographer, this person's a dancer. I didn't grow up around people with normal, quote unquote, normal jobs.
Yeah.
And so I really didn't have a model of what a life like that would be like. I only was modeled creative lifestyles and I liked it. So
very
right in.
Very bohemian. Is
oh,
that
completely.
The word?
Yeah. We definitely wore a lot of tie-dye. So.
Oh, tie-dye. Okay. All right. So look, so then So you're getting exposed to this and you're getting really interested. When do you start singing? When do you start dancing? Like, when do you really start to get immersed into these things in a way that like you want to harness your ability to perform and then also just get better and better? Like, when does that start?
So I would say that my first form of expression was dance from the time I was, you know, a baby, really, because the house was always filled with music. If it wasn't being played, it was being listened to.
Yeah.
And I would just move and dance. And I was dancing around so much that my mom put me in ballet class at Dance Theater of Harlem. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I would also, from age 2, reach up to the piano and like make up little songs.
Oh, interesting.
And my mom actually found recently, she was like going through a box that was in storage, a cassette tape. Remember those?
I love cassettes and VHSs. Those are the best. Yeah, yeah.
She found a cassette tape of a song that I wrote, and it was like Andromeda, 2 years old. And it was a little song that I wrote about like me and my cousin walking to the playground.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not a great song, but you know.
It's descriptive of something you did, right?
It was very narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, creating. So like creating a song and a narrative is something like that I did from a very young age. So my mom wanted to get me piano lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew sort of like the Suzuki, very traditional method, probably wouldn't be a match for her really free spirit child. So that's how I ended up studying with Cenelia Smith.
Yeah.
And Cenelia Smith was amazing because he allowed me to play my original compositions, but he would make sure that my hand position was correct.
Right.
And he did teach me, like, you know, Bach and all that kind of stuff. But then he would let me improvise with it. He wasn't like, you can only play it like, you know, he wasn't. Yeah. He allowed my creativity to flourish. And I really am grateful that I had a teacher that continued to allow me to explore that instead of, you know, squashing it.
Rigid. Yeah. It's like the difference between, or I guess the combination of like rigid in terms of developing structure, but then also like spontaneity or autonomy to develop your own style. It seems like that's the yin and yang that he fostered. So, so then is that, but when do you like, when are you like, this is what I want to do? Like, I definitely want to be in like performing for a living. Like, when do you make that? Is that a jump or is that more like it feels natural based on what my interests are, what my family does and what I want to do?
I always knew that I would be some type of performer and have some type of creative career. And I thought that I was going to be a dancer. And then when I hit puberty and I'm like 5'8" and I was much taller than like the girls in my ballet class. And I wasn't heavy by any means, but I was, you know, more full figured than what a typical ballerina
like looks very
like.
Petite. Yeah.
Yeah. I was not flat chested. I was not a size 00.
Right.
And sort of looking at what was working and what kind of jobs might be available for me with the way that I looked at the time, I didn't really think that it would be possible. And that was kind of sad for me because I was like, oh, I didn't really know what I was going to do. And at that time, I wasn't really singing. We're talking like middle school, high school.
Okay.
And so middle school, I started singing in the school choir and had a great teacher, Mrs. Cool. And that was super fun. And then when I got to high school, we had a great musical theater program at our high school. And I went to audition to just be in the ensemble because I was like, oh, I could dance. I could do like the background parts. And I sang in the choir in middle school. So I know I can like sing the choir parts in the background. And I auditioned and God bless him, Patrick Dearborn was the theater director. He put me as the lead in the school musical. And I was like, sir, what are you doing?
He saw it.
Yeah.
He saw it before you did.
And he really coached the person that I am now out of me because he saw it and he was like, no, you're supposed to be in the front. You're not supposed to be in the back. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to do this like dance thing over here, sing some background parts. And he was like, no, baby, you're a star.
All right.
He was the best.
That's support.
And he really gave me a lot of encouragement, a lot of training, a lot of constructive criticism and a lot of love.
Okay.
And I think by the time I graduated high school, I really had just about everything I needed.
Yeah. All right. So then, and then you went to the Boston Conservatory.
I went to Boston Conservatory. I did not love the Boston Conservatory.
Oh, why is that?
It was just not a lot of opportunities or inclusion for people of color.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I felt very ostracized there. And I felt very unwelcome and very uncomfortable, both by the offerings that were made by the school and by the other students there.
So you didn't feel like included?
I felt intentionally excluded.
Wow.
And so that's like not really an environment where you're going to flourish.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. And the other thing that I really hated about the Boston Conservatory is because I was there as a theater major and not a music major. I was not allowed to take out the practice rooms with pianos.
Oh, man.
So I couldn't. And I took piano lessons all the way through my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
From the time I was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 with Sennelius.
Right.
And so playing the piano and writing my own songs was something that I had done my whole life. And that was also a form of like therapy and release for me.
Yeah. And they didn't let you do it.
I didn't have it and they wouldn't let me do it.
Wow.
And I also don't do well in like rigid, structured environments. And I'm like, are you insane?
Yeah, that's messed up. There seemed really black and white
about it. Yeah. I'm like, guys, you have a theater major that can play the piano. Like, don't you
want... Yeah, it's like, relax.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. So things have changed now, I've heard, because they're also a part of Berklee now. It's like a totally different thing. But I went there in 2000. And that was the deal. And I didn't like it. And so I left. I took a semester off and I decided that I was quitting music.
Oh, no. Because of that? Because of that experience?
Yeah. I really, it kind of broke my spirit because you have to understand that I came from a childhood where everybody that I knew was creative professionals.
Yeah.
And was thriving. And then I had this magical experience through middle school and high school where I was nurtured and I was appreciated and I was given opportunity. And then all, and then it went to like, you're, you don't belong here. You're not welcome here. You can't do this. You can't do that. And I just had no tools to manage any of
coping.
That.
You didn't have the coping mechanisms yet.
Yeah. No, I had none of the coping mechanisms.
No sound baths.
I have now.
Yeah.
There were no sound baths. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
So that was tough.
It was tough. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I should do something more practical, but I still wanted to be creative. And I've always loved doing makeup. And so I did like a little get your makeup license thing. And I actually was working on Broadway at the Phantom of the Opera. Doing makeup for Hugh Panero was the Phantom at the time.
Wow. What a woman of many talents. Makeup. Let's add that to the list. That's awesome. Was that fulfilling for you?
No, but I tried to, you know, convince myself that it was because I was like, I'm still creative.
Yeah.
You're still like Broadway art on people's faces. Mm-hmm. You're like music adjacent because you're doing makeup for a performer.
So some rationalizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a Christmas party at Phantom and it was like a karaoke Christmas party. And I sang something. I don't remember what I sang. And Hugh Panero was like, why are you my makeup artist?
It changed everything.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
And I sort of explained to him the situation and I was like, you know, I just don't think that there's like space for me. I it's not working. I'm just going to do makeup. And he was like, you're crazy. Go back.
Yeah. So, this guy like supported you even when like you come out of the Boston Conservatory and you're like, I don't even want to do music anymore. And they're like, and then you almost through their observation of your passion and your talent, they were like, no, you need to do this. Like, don't just let this step feel like a step back. It's actually, it could be a step in a different direction or a step forward.
Yeah. And you know what? I actually have never spoken about is during that time in my life, I actually really struggled with panic attacks constantly. Mm-hmm. And I would have panic attacks that were so bad that they would put me in the hospital.
Wow.
But I was like 18, 19 years old, right? You don't really understand what's going on.
No.
And so as soon as I went back to doing music, all of that went away.
Because it was because you had some coping in place.
No, I think it was that I was off my path.
Yeah.
I was trying to be reasonable. I was trying to be like, you know, smart about life.
Okay.
And I was doing something that I felt like, you know what, you're 18, you need to be responsible and you need to learn how to take care of yourself and like pay your bills, just take a job and like, this is your life now. And my spirit was like,
yeah,
I had so much anxiety and panic. And then as soon as I went back to Berkeley and I was in an environment where I was doing music and creating my own sounds, all of that went away. And I didn't do like therapy or anything for it. Like the music really healed that because I was back where I was supposed to be.
So that was really therapeutic for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then, okay. And then you decide, so then at what point do you decide to like go to Berkeley? Was it after that?
Yeah. So that was like the Christmas party. And then the next September I started at Berkeley.
Yeah. Cause it sounds like, did you see that movie, High Fidelity?
No.
It's like with John Cusack. All right. Well, it's like it takes place in like a music store, like a record shop, a record store. And there's like Jack Black, and no one thinks he's like capable of singing. And then at the end he like belts out this like incredible tune, and everyone is like on the floor. It's like, did you feel like I was misunderstood? And then after that moment, like with him, and when you sang, you're like, I feel like I'm discovered now. Cause it seems like you found your identity almost, like even through that experience, like you harnessed all of this strife and then you had the panic and you just, it's almost like you funneled it in a way that kind of continued your evolution creatively. Do you feel like you got that? Like, is that how you think about it, or do you have a different take on it?
I think that's a big part of it. Yes, you are not wrong. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the biggest takeaway that I got from that experience is that I'm supposed to do a certain thing while I'm here. I have a song that I wrote, and the first line of it is, we only have one life we can confirm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So as far as I know, and as far as anyone can prove, I only get to be Andromeda this one time. And I think that for me, for my soul and my life's experience, it is very clear what I am supposed to be doing. And when I am not doing that, I sort of spiral out of control.
Right. So purpose.
I don't know if that is the case for everybody, but mm-hmm. that is definitely the case for me. It's one of the reasons why I wrote that show based on the Japanese concept of ikigai, which I learned about when I lived in Japan for like almost 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And then I learned, do you know what ikigai is?
No.
It's this Japanese philosophy. The word means a reason for being.
Okay.
And there's sort of a Venn diagram of what that is. And it's a combination of what you love, mm-hmm. what you're good at, mm-hmm. what the world needs, and what you can be paid for.
Wow. Interesting.
Right. And sort of having this balance. And I find that people that I know that are successful and happy, and by successful, I don't mean like they have
money.
Two yachts and four private planes. I mean, they wake up every day and enjoy their lives and their needs are met.
Yeah.
To me, that is successful. Those people are all living their ikigai. They all have that balance. They're doing something that they love, that they're good at, that the world needs for them to do, that they can be paid for.
Yeah, that's a great philosophy. It's like practical, but it also meets the internal needs for fulfillment. That's a hard word. Fulfillment.
Yeah,
I
the
kind
world
of almost
did not
it.
Need for me to put eyelashes on people.
Oh yeah. Well, hey, maybe there's still time, but there's still time to like blend. Maybe you can blend the eyelashes with a new album. Maybe that makes it to the visual component of your next album.
I definitely like to do good makeup when I'm on stage. If I'm not on stage, I don't wear makeup. But yeah.
Okay. So then Berkeley, how was that experience? Good experience?
It was interesting experience. Okay. I made a lot of really great musical connections and musical friendships that I still lean into today
mm-hmm.
that are still a part of, you know, people that I perform with or turn to for guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I also, this was very revelatory for me, that I had learned so much in my childhood that there wasn't a whole lot that I needed Berkeley to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the primary things that I learned at Berkeley were how to like physically write out my charts and like write for a big band or write for a string section.
Technical stuff.
Yeah, those kind of technical things I really learned a lot at Berkeley, and the networking was great, but
mm-hmm.
I didn't really feel like, wow, I'm getting so much information that I really needed to learn here. And so when I got the opportunity to go on the road with Ray Charles, I left. I never finished at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hate it. I didn't have a bad experience, but I was kind of like, this is nice.
Right. Yeah. Like you didn't come there to be molded in a certain sense. It seems like you were already getting, like you got so much exposure. And I don't know how many others had the same, like, you talk about growing up jazz. Like, I don't know how many others necessarily grew up in that same, type of family. I mean, that's a very unique experience, you know, that you had. And it feels like you already had a lot of training before that helped mold you in a way. And I don't know it seems like you didn't really come there for that, but then maybe you got some other things out of it. So then you performed at the commencement, right?
I did. I sang at the commencement with Diane Reeves and Steven Tyler. And then I was like, bye.
How was that commencement?
That was so epic. Diane Reeves is still one of my favorite singers ever. She is magical. And Steven Tyler, like, are you kidding me? Dream on. Like, he's a legend. So that was really special. And then it was also sort of like, once you've sung as like a sophomore or whatever I was at the commencement with Diane Reeves and Steven Tyler, like, what else am I going to do here?
Do you play Diane Reeves on your show?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah, you do. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I played her this weekend. I played Nine, which is my favorite Diane Reeves composition.
Mm, okay.
If you don't know that song, listen to it. Diane Reeves, Nine. It's amazing.
Okay. So that, and then Ray Charles, legend.
Yeah.
The legend. All right. Yeah. So then how do you go from Berkeley? So you go from Berkeley to working, I guess, with him and being the last, one of the last Ray Letts.
Yeah.
So that was that combination, like you talked about, like we talked about the eyelashes and the singing and blending it. So was it kind of like that, like combining dance, singing, like what did you do with Ray?
Harmonies. That was all the choral harmonies. Work that I did, was really helpful for that. Cause everything was in 5-part harmonies and I was the second soprano. So being able to hear those intervals and blend with the other singers were the critical skills that I needed to make that opportunity a success.
Okay. And Ray Charles, what was your sense of him?
He was so lovely. I mean, he was a very old man and he was already sick by the time I got to work with him. So like the Ray Charles that you see in the movie, Ray with Jamie Foxx is not the Ray Charles. I had like the grandpa version of Ray Charles.
Okay.
So there was all of that craziness in the movie. I watched the movie after he died and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. He had the habits. The ineffective coping strategies.
Exactly.
Lived a long time.
And the man was blind. Like, give him a break.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. All right. What a life. What a life. Yeah. All right. So then after that, so at this point, are you thinking like, I want to do solo work? Or what is your kind of, what are you thinking at that point?
I was thinking to do background vocals. I have always keep trying to put myself in the back.
Even though,
I'll do background vocals. Like I work at Saturday Night Live. I'm like, I'm fine. I'm in the booth. I'm doing the background vocals, you know, like I sung background vocals for different people. I keep trying to put myself in the back and life keeps putting me in the front. And it's only like since I've turned 40 that I have just fully accepted that like I need to be in the front.
Yeah.
And I need to create opportunities for myself where I'm in the front. And this album is really my first venture into that. I really feel like this is in a lot of ways my first album as me.
The one that you're putting out now.
The one that will come out this summer, yeah.
Okay. Why?
Well, I only have 2 full albums that I have done before. One of them I self-produced, recorded, did all the either compositions or arrangements if they were covers or standards.
Right.
When I was 24 years old, living in Japan. And I don't know very many people that have a firm grasp on who they are, or what they want to say to the world at 24. I most certainly didn't. It was just kind of like, here are some songs that I like and so that you can hear my voice. And I was strategic about it because I did know that I wanted to work in like doing hotel gigs. There's a whole market where like you get hotel contracts and you live in a country for like 6, 7, 8 months.
Wow.
Singing at a hotel and they put you up and it's really nice. And so I knew I wanted to go into that. So I sort of created this album so I could use it as like a marketing tool to get those jobs. But it really wasn't like a reflection of like
where you were creatively.
And
I
didn't even know who I was at 24.
Yeah. Did you go
then
ahead.
Then Shine, which is the one that I recorded when I was pregnant and I had like 5 minutes to think about it.
Yeah.
And now this project, which I have been working on for over a year.
Right. And then, all right. But in the first one, and you had, were you listening? Because you did a Chet Baker tune, right?
Which one?
The Funny Valentine.
Oh, My Funny Valentine. I never think of that as a Chet Baker tune.
Oh, what do you think about it as?
I don't, I just think of
it's like its own thing. Yeah,
yeah, I just think of it as a standard. I don't really associate it with any particular artist.
How do you feel about Chet Baker?
I really don't like Chet Baker.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry.
Because is it because he's not like the best singer or what's the.
I think that he's one of those singers that has a very recognizable voice. He's not a bad singer. He doesn't sing out of tune.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to go for musicians that include singers that have a different rhythmic sensibility. I like a lot of rhythm and polyrhythms, and I feel like his music is a lot more square.
Yeah, accessible.
And yeah, it's very accessible.
Yeah.
I play Chet Baker on my show because I understand like people like Chet Baker. I don't like hate Chet Baker, right?
Sure.
But I never like actively choose to like listen to Chet Baker because there's just something in his rhythmic concept that doesn't really do it for me.
Right. Yeah. You never know like what type of music will move you and move someone else. It's kind of interesting. It's almost like, I feel like it's a DNA thing. Like some things just resonate with some people and then other things don't.
If it doesn't make me want to dance, I don't like it. That's pretty firm general rule of music. Like it could be music from anywhere in the world. If it has a rhythm that like makes me do dance in some kind of way, I will probably like the music. And his music does not make me want to dance in any type of way, or even like tap my foot or sway my shoulders.
All right. What about like, but bebop? That makes that's like made for dance, right?
Yeah. That stuff is killing.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I like about your shows. You blend a lot of that. And then you definitely play a lot of your father, which is always nice to hear, right?
Yeah,
that's true.
Why not?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Keep the legend alive in the hearts of so many people that maybe aren't familiar with it. And then also just why not? It's good music.
Yeah, it's good music.
Like, come on, man. There are no rules. It's collaboration. Okay. So
I get, the more I do what I want.
Yeah, why
turning
not?
Turning into my grandmother. My grandmother told me, don't ask for permission. Apologize if you need to.
Interesting. Okay. I agree with that. I that a lot. It's good music. Come on, relax.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I have moved past like needing to ask for permission. It's not like I'm trying to do things that are terrible anyway.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know.
How did the growing up jazz, because that's something, I think that's like a tenet of your connecting the world to jazz on some level. And then also related to your familial musical traditions. How did that start?
That started because both when I was like at Berkeley and then beyond that, like doing work with schools and stuff and just looking at books and documentaries that were out there about jazz, mm-hmm. I felt like the narrative of the history of jazz was so different from the way that I knew it. And I knew it extremely intimately. And I felt that there was a huge like absence of Black perspectives, to be honest mm-hmm. with you. If you look at most of the books that are written about jazz, most of the lecturers on jazz, most of the people that have made documentaries about jazz, it's white men. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that they're documenting it and writing about it. I'm not here to say like white men should not do these things.
Right.
But they often, and in the instances of everything that I read and consumed when I decided to make Growing Up Jazz, completely missed out on an opportunity. It's exactly what I said to you about Billie Holiday, right? Like they talk about Billie Holiday and her importance in the music and her incredible, like everything, but they left. And I'm like, how can you leave this out? How can you talk about the battle of the bands between, you know, Benny Goodman's band and, oh my God, I'm like blanking, but like, how can you talk about these things and not mention that, you know, the Black musicians had to come in through the back door and they couldn't even use the bathroom at the Savoy. Like, how do you leave all of this out? This is really, really important for people to understand their perspective.
Yeah, it's like selective narrative. Yeah,
of course. And sometimes it's intentional. And having met and talked to a lot of these people that have written these things, it's honestly just like something that they never considered or were even aware of. Right? Because it's not a part of their life's experience. So they don't necessarily think to look for those things. It's not always like with malintent. They're not like, well, I'm going to leave out all of the racism. It's just like, oh, they don't experience racism. So it's not something that they think to look for or to include in the narrative.
Even though that's like the most important thing to include.
In a lot
because
of ways,
without
yes.
that, it's not the same story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not the same story. And so I wanted to fill in those gaps. And I also see jazz as the oral history of the African experience in America. And you can trace the music from Africa through work songs, through spirituals, through the blues, through jazz. Mm-hmm. And with every decade and generation of Africans living in America, how the music changed depending on what their lives were like, what they culturally and societally were experiencing. And with each generation, they incorporated the sounds and the stories of their generation in the music. So even if we go back to like slavery days and work songs, because that's part of the history of jazz where it developed out of, what they're singing about, Africans living in America at that time could not read or write. It was against the law. And so if you want their perspectives, if you want to know what they thought it was like being enslaved, listen to the music. The stories are all there.
It's not
like
selective.
We can read a slave master's diary, but we don't have a slave's diary in most instances. Right.
And their perspective is the one.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
It's in the music.
Yeah. So you got to have both.
Yeah.
You can't
so
just have
bringing
one.
Those things. Yeah. So that's why I created it. And that's sort of what I trace is like how the music goes through the timeline and why it is important right now to still use jazz as an oral history tradition and still use jazz as a reflection of our experience in the world right now, which is one of the reasons why I created Growing Up Jazz. And it's also why this album that I'm doing now is so important.
Mm-hmm. Have you named the album yet?
It's called From the Earth.
Okay. Yeah. From the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the earth.
It really is from the earth. It had magical beginnings. My best friend, Laura, and her husband, Tony, I was there when they got married. I was one of the bridesmaids. And she calls me up and she's like, Tony and I have our 20th wedding anniversary and we're renewing our vows and we want you and Lars, my husband, to be there. And I'm like, of course, I wouldn't miss it. She's like, cool. We're going to do this inside a glacier in Iceland.
Wow. That's like, awesome.
What?
Yeah.
They are not Icelandic. Like none of it made sense. But I was like, you know what? Let's go. Come on. We're going to do it.
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. And let's go.
I had a really busy work schedule. I did zero research on Iceland. I just sort of like booked the flight and clicked the hotel that she said to book a room at. And like,
you listen to Bjork. That's research.
I love Bjork. She is probably my favorite artist of all time. But the actual country itself, I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
And I got there and I experienced a closeness with nature in a way that I never had before. And it was profound.
Wow.
I was inside a glacier. Okay. I saw the aurora borealis, and that actually was crazy because there were two nights in a row when I saw the aurora and I was standing outside. They were directly above my head. It was a low air pressure day, so they felt like they were like so close to me that I could almost touch them, even though I couldn't. And I could feel them. I felt like I got plugged into like an electrical socket or something. I could feel the energy and the current like running through my body. Not in a painful way, but this is what I mean when I say like I feel and experience things. I was standing right next to my husband who was like, oh, that's pretty.
It didn't hit him the same way.
I was like, you don't feel that? And he's like, feel what? And I'm like, I literally feel like I've been plugged into an electrical socket right now.
Yeah. It's energizing.
I could feel the aurora in my body. Yeah. Like it was crazy. And watching a volcano erupt and watching the formation of new earth.
Wow.
And standing on a black sand beach and watching like chunks of ice like violently get pushed on the shore. Like all of these things just had such a profound impact on me. I went back to the hotel room and just on my laptop, I started recording in the outlines to four songs that I wrote, one for each of those elements: ice, earth, sky, and sea.
Wow.
And I came back to America and I was like, what am I going to do with this music? I really like it. But I'm not Icelandic. I am not the person to do like, here's my album about Iceland that one time I went there. Like,
hi, Bjork.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I was like, how can I sort of translate this really profound experience and connection that I had to the earth with what is relevant in my country and in my life? And I started researching climate change here. And shocker to absolutely no one who understands how things work in America, the communities that are suffering the most are marginalized communities.
Of course. Always.
I also do, especially through Growing Up Jazz, but through that has led me to do a lot of DEI work. I was the chair of diversity, equity, and inclusion for my town for years. I've done consulting for companies and schools. I have my certificate from Cornell University to do DEI work. And so when I learned that, I was like, I know exactly what to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I understand policy. Like, I was like, I know what to do now.
Yeah.
And so I spent the year researching, interviewing people from these communities. And I picked four communities. Each one reflects a different element: earth, sea, sky, and air.
Right.
And ice, rather. And their interviews have sort of shaped how the rest of this suite, it's a suite that I composed. So each element has three songs.
Wow.
The first song, really, its job is to bring the listener into that element. So the mm-hmm. names of the songs are Geosphere, Atmosphere, Hydrosphere, and Cryosphere.
Oh, interesting.
So that's the first thing you hear when you sort of enter each element. Then the second song has excerpts from an interview that I did with someone from one of those communities. And you literally get to hear firsthand from them what it is like.
Wow.
And then I have like a third song that sort of like ties it up. That's my interpretation of this whole thing.
So there's like lots of layers to this.
There's a lot of layers to it. And we did the first concert of it. And I set up the format for how I plan to tour with this project, which is I did it in my hometown because why not debut it here?
Yeah.
We have a great performance space. And I invited local environmental groups to come and table. I did not charge them to come and table at my event.
Yeah.
I put them in the programs. I let them speak before the show started. And the goal was to connect my community not only with these four communities that they're hearing about, but with initiatives that are happening right here. Like, did you know that you can get a free energy coach to come to your house and do an audit? Did you know that you can compost here? Did you like connecting people with their own communities to help impact the environment in positive ways? And so as I tour with this project, that is the goal for every city that I go to research local environmental groups and give them an opportunity to present.
Man, that's awesome.
Thank you. You're changing
the world, man. I think that's like the key element, I think, in your art, which is it's almost like, you know, you mentioned Max Roach being inclusive of like your mother's pregnancy, but it's like, you're furthering his theme of inclusion. Like maybe when he held you in his arms, he imparted some inclusiveness that you're imparting with your theme.
I want to accept that so much. Thank you.
Yeah. No, definitely. And look, I mean, it was great. It was great talking to you. This was fun. I enjoyed this.
Thank you.
And I really appreciated listening about the new album, From the Earth. And I want to listen to it soon, and I'm excited to you know, this summer when it comes out. And this is fun. Andromeda
out July 19th is the release date. I don't have the release date for the singles yet, but we're doing a listening party, an early listening party. I'll make sure you get an invitation. That's going to be on April 4th.
Okay.
And that's going to be at a gallery at Arts Westchester. And the purpose of that is that I'm also working on an entire like visual album and art gallery show that goes with this album.
Wow.
So there's going to be like sculptures and paintings and photographs and like part of my process and projections and all kinds of stuff.
So it's like the experience you had in Iceland. You're almost like transducing that here in a way that's inclusive, first of all, but then also that accounts for the different ways that we feel things and that we experience things and not just in one medium, which I think is a testament to what I said. I mean, that's really cool. Like, I really appreciate your work and really appreciate you coming on. And I love your show, by the way. Like, I listen to it all the time.
You.
I love real jazz. I like Christian McBride, of course.
Of course.
Marcus Miller is great. I mean, they're both, of course, legends as well. But I think that I like that your show is on the weekends, which is nice because sometimes you need to decompress, you know? And I'm always trying to refine my coping strategies. And that's what it's like. Sound baths for you and your
real
show
jazz
for me.
For
so
you.
Real jazz for me, real jazz with Andromeda, Teray. Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on. This was such a pleasure and a blast for me.
Yeah, likewise. And I will keep you posted and make sure you get an invitation for the gallery show.
Okay. I expect nothing less.
Okay. Take care.